The two things I promised you as my treats. The contending theories as to what happened with Saturn in Christchurch, we've heard the one that I attribute it to, which was the potential for Telecom, there I go again, to do pocket pricing. There was an alternative theory that it was all to do with the fact that UIH, the parent company of Saturn at that stage, was making so many losses in Australia that they could no longer afford to invest in New Zealand. I must dispute that because at the time I was working for Austar, which was the UIH company in Australia. Actually, there was some truth in that. And the other one is the fact that really to make their business case fly, they not only needed to do Christchurch and Wellington, they also needed to do Auckland. And when Auckland became all too hard for them for getting planning consent on their cable, that they then said, well, if we can't do Auckland, we might as well just stop. Meanwhile, one of the technical staff here has also pointed out to me he used to work for Wellington City Council and worked on the getting the resource management consent for the Saturn cable in Wellington, and they cleared all the way for that cable to be deployed, and his calculation is that 100,000 customers in Wellington were saving $10 a month. That's $10 million a year, which if you use a multiplier of 7 times for the economic benefit of that kind of saving is $70 million. And he thought from an economic development perspective that looked like a pretty good planning decision. So you see immediately that nothing in this industry is as easy as it seems or as transparent. And that's the second story coming to peering. It is often reported that the peering arrangements in Australia emerged because of the competition notice that was issued by the ACCC in 1999. When UUNet and which was Aussie Mail and Connect, which became AAPT, were already peering between themselves and sought to peer with Telstra, and Telstra was refusing to. Whilst it's true that there was a competition notice issued and the peering arrangements emerged after that, at the same time, what had also happened was UUNet and Connect both decided they would no longer buy transit from Telstra in Australia. They both decided that they would only buy transmission directly to America and told Telstra, pick up our traffic in Los Angeles. And that changed the economic equation for Telstra sufficiently that even without the competition notice they were going to agree to do peering anyway. So for those of you who are thinking about peering, you do need to think about how you can change that incentive. On the flip side, because of that issue, when I was at AAPT, we were concerned about whether we'd face a competition notice about peering. We established a peering policy, which we put up on our website, and we dealt with every comer on that basis. We had a few people we did peer with just ourselves, but we actually, as Scott pointed out, we had a number of people who realised that the cost of actually meeting the criteria, the cost of meeting the criteria to peer meant that the benefit over the transit they were saving wasn't worthwhile. So the peering story is actually a lot more complicated than sometimes it appears. Enough of that, that's just some history. We've got two really great speakers this afternoon and I'll introduce them separately. I've actually worked with both these gentlemen in my past incarnation. I've actually worked with our first speaker 4 times. We worked together in Telstra in the media account team. We then worked together at Hutchison doing mobile networks. He then was my vendor building for Lucent when AAPT was not building a mobile network. And more recently, we've actually spent some time doing some work together at Unwired. Chris brings a wide background in telecommunications, as you can see, to the field. And today, he's going to talk to us about wireless access networks. Could you please welcome Chris Coughlan?
Thank you, and given that Dave's just taken up 5 minutes of my time, I'll get straight to it. The contents I'm going to quickly cover, I'm going to talk a little bit about standards, only going to talk about 3GPP and WiMAX because they're the only two relevant ones in this market. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about WiMAX and LTE similarities and differences, look at some new market opportunities right? Then some quick thoughts on spectrum and then a conclusion. So without further ado, from a standards perspective, 3GPP is basically a mobile evolution of standards. Current sort of iteration of that is the UMTS standards. They're based on wideband CDMA, and there's been a lot of development to enhance that as far as the data rates go. And we now see, the Release 6, the HSPA-type deployments now in networks around the world. Further to that, there's going to be more enhancements on HSPA, HSPA Plus, more basically enhancing the data throughputs, reducing the latency on the networks to improve the services we provide, and more importantly, the capacity that you have on those networks. The big sort of, I think it's more revolution than an evolution, is LTE, because we changed the air interface to OFDM. That will be available in around about probably pilots later this year, deployments early next year. That's really sort of maximising the efficiencies of these networks. The corollary to that is the WiMAX standards. Fundamentally, there's sort of two important ones. There's the 802.16d standard, which was basically a fixed wireless type standard. You had, there wasn't any intelligent antennas. Was utilised 64 QAM both on the uplink and downlink, and really it basically provided wireless broadband access, and hence things like VoIP was treated like you would treat VoIP on standard networks. Development of that, which is now available, is the 802.16e network. This is mainly a centrally controlled wireless access network based on the WiMAX standards. It's TDD. It only utilises 16 QAM in the uplink, so uplink is not quite as efficient as the D standard. It has some mobility features, but not fully developed. And currently still really, from a voice perspective, behind the LTE and UMTS standards. If we look at efficiencies of these networks, there's a law, Shannon's law, which talks about the efficiencies of, in terms of the rate you can get from an air interface against the signal noise ratio. So all these standards, whether they be HSDPA, HSPA, 802.16, are all within 3 dB of the Shannon bound. So they're very, very efficient, and they're really no more or less efficient than the other ones. The efforts now are really to maximise the signal noise ratio. So in the CDMA thing, we see noise cancellation and efforts to improve equalisation, to improve the performance by improving the signal noise ratio, because at the end of the day, we're talking about basic physics here. Looking at the similarities and differences between WiMAX and LTE, they both use OFDM-A in the downlink. Framing-wise, they're different. WiMAX uses a 5-millisecond frame. LTE is a 1-millisecond frame. What this means is that things like power control, error correction, or retransmission of errored packets can happen quicker in the LTE market, and it's more optimised for voice in that way. On the uplink, WiMAX uses, again, OFDMA on the uplink, whereas LTE uses SCFDMA. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but essentially that... all things being equal, should provide LTE with greater coverage compared to WiMAX, especially for mobile devices. From a VoIP perspective, WiMAX, they're using standard sort of codecs that you use now on broadband, and so it's not as efficient as what will be available with LTE and HSPA Plus as far as VoIP type traffic goes. From a mobility perspective, and power control, WiMAX is definitely behind the LTE standards. I suppose that the big difference here is that WiMAX is available now, and so therefore has an early mover advantage. LTE, as I said, probably next year. I'll quickly talk about new market opportunities. So, and the Commerce Commission was keen for me to keep that bit of the presentation short so I could talk about this stuff. If we think about where we're going to go from now, back when we sort of came up with UMTS and CDMA, we were spinning as a vendor, I was a vendor then, spinning the story about high-speed data for enterprises, which is about enabling, you know, the workforce to be able to access, you know, keep the people out in the field more often, drive productivity, and that was really, I suppose, the driving force for data enabling on those initial networks. Nowadays, we see that's done and dusted. You know, mobile data, even consumer mobile data, is well accepted and out there. Yesterday, we heard a talk about, I think, bots. Now, from my perspective, that's machine to machine, right? So I did some digging around for some data on machine to machine. I found some data out of Sensor Philly Consulting, who have a prediction here on 2014 of the number of machine-to-machine devices that are going to be in the market. And if we just do a quick equation, that equates to, you know, from their predictions, 20 to 40 million devices in the New Zealand market, if we take the 5 per population to 10 per population figure. So significant opportunity. I then went ahead and looked at the GSMA and found some addressable market figures for machine-to-machine type applications or in particular embedded devices. And what they've done, this is addressable market, so when we look at the bottom big numbers, we're talking about people. So there's 1 billion people who are overweight. I hope I'm not one. There's something like 840-odd million people who are chronic disease patients. So these are all addressable potential market for machine-to-machine type monitoring of the condition of these people. The rest of the machine type numbers are basically just figures on, you know, how many devices are sort of rolling out in the next 12 months. Again, big market. I then thought, well, what's the difference between this retail and vertical markets? How are they machine-to-machine vertical markets? How are they different? The vertical markets, you know, low churn because usually there's a big investment up front and you don't want to be changing investment and streams on a hurry. There's relatively low acquisition costs because you're not subsidising devices. Generally, you know, that's going to be covered by the business, whereas you have, you know, relatively high ARPU on things like the device in the retail consumer world. You know, realistically, they're going to be very low average revenue per connection, I've called it. You know, retail short-term contracts, long-term sort of contracts in the vertical area, high number of devices per contract. Very predictable market because we're talking about telemetry machine to machine and hence it's sort of repeatable sort of traffic profiles. Mass market versus a fragmented market. There'll be performance requirements in contracts. And essentially, as I said before, the devices and the networks, the integration will be paid by the customer. If we consider the sort of existing paradigm and how that relates, you know, existing telcos are sort of measured on a couple of things, KPIs, ARPU and churn. It's sort of two that crop up quite regularly. And they, you know, they sell sort of individual services to people. You know, sometimes they're bundled, but essentially they're multiple services on one bill. The M2M type services could impact these key metrics. If you start wrapping them in, if you're only getting a couple of bucks a month for a machine-to-machine device, and then all of a sudden that brings down your average revenue per user if you start calculating that way. And that may impact some of the thoughts around whether this should be adopted or even chased. So continue on though, that WiMAX and LTE enable, and to a degree HSPA Plus and HSPA will enable some of these M2M type, you know, inherently these are IP-based networks, they'll have QoS, you'll be able to manage and report and on the terms of your contract as far as your performance guarantees. They'll have a large amount of capacity when they're initially deployed, and they'll be sort of, you can see from the earlier slides, there'll be high demand. Here, another slide I've adapted from somebody else, but tries to sort of identify that the traffic profile for some of these machine-to-machine applications. And if we look at things, and you, one of the things that really strikes me is the fact that in the current sort of world, most of our traffic is on the downlink. It's to the device, right? With these things, it's mainly in the uplink. Relatively low data requirements, but it's uplink orientated. The only exception being things like, you know, remote surveillance where you're streaming video. You know, that's in the uplink, but it's going to be high volume. And I've got mobile workforce there as an example of, you know, the current sort of paradigm. Here I've sort of said, well, we can then sort of map these applications as far as, well, are they mobile or are they fixed, and are they low traffic or high traffic? And for a new entrant, this is something that sort of helps you sort of target where you want to go to a degree. You know, you'd aim to sort of go for fixed devices because they're not moving about, they don't have a requirement for mobility, and therefore as you build your network, you can target different requirements and different services. And, you know, they cover both low and high traffic requirements if you want to go that way. I put some thoughts into sort of, well, how do you price these things, right? So you've got these different applications, and this is not prescriptive, but it sort of, you can think of, well, what are the resources that are used by the network, how predictable is the traffic, and therefore you can say, well, you know, things like telemetry devices, very predictable traffic, so hey, you could just charge them at a flat rate, keep it simple, right? Same with vehicle telematics, financial transactions, high value to the end user, so therefore maybe, you know, you do it as a transactional type price. You know, surveillance, again, it's high data volume. You know, we're talking about streaming video 24/7. So, you know, you can charge that as a data volume or as a fixed rate, again, because it's very predictable. Who to target? So we had a bit of a discussion about whether they're mobile fixed. I then had a thought about, well, you know, tried to map value per sale against demand concentration. So if we look at the top right, we've got things like the utility market, and I've got a specific sole line in that because I think it's a market that's about to explode. So the utility market, which is fundamentally a monopoly, but the value per sale is quite high. Whereas you look right down in things like smart home devices, you know, where you're selling to individual households, it's right down the bottom end, so, you know, sales low, and it's also individual users. And in the middle is all the sort of corporate type applications or sales targets. Energy distribution, I wanted to just to talk a little bit about this because I've been doing a bit of work in Australia around this space. So in the energy market, I suppose, there is a high cost to the energy distributors for unforecasted peak demand. So when all of a sudden they need more power from generators, it costs them a lot of money. And also there's an overall growing demand for electricity, and it's driven by things like air conditioners and consumer devices and whatnot. So we've got a growing demand, we've got high cost if you don't forecast it right. So there's a movement to make some of these grids more intelligent. And that's because at the end of the day, there's also a capped supply of power that you can actually generate from generators. In Australia, you know, there's also a carbon issue because most of our power comes from coal. So there's a drive to make grids more efficient, and they call it the smart grids. It's basically turning dumb electricity distribution into intelligent power distribution networks. Then there's a smart metering concept, which is about connecting these smart meters all the way back to a central sort of database to improve efficiency by, you know, you don't need those guys going out to read meters once a quarter, but also providing real-time feedback to the people in the household on what their usage is. So coming back to the Google type model, but this is not predictive. This is, you know, a real measurement of your power usage, and then a reward or punishment type mechanism as far as rates to actually try and change people's behaviour. So what this means is that it, you know, and we're talking, you know, one power company in, say, New South Wales, they've got 2 million odd metres on their network, plus around 30,000 to 40,000 other devices to manage and monitor and control. So this represents partnering opportunities for new entrants and also millions of connections for incumbents. Oh, I'm moving quick. Spectrum thoughts, these new technologies require big bandwidth. So even the GSMA admits that, you know, for LTE is only more efficient when you deploy it in 10 megahertz channels. WiMAX, you know, fundamentally you really want to deploy it in 10 megahertz channels, and most people are using 3-to-1 reuse, so therefore you need 30 megahertz to deploy WiMAX. You've got growing sort of demand and saturation of broadband data, especially when the prices come down. In Australia, we've seen, you know, real big capacity issues on some of the networks around mobile data. And then the suitability of existing spectrum, well, it's really not suitable. Like 2G spectrum really isn't suitable for LTE because, number one, it's usually not in big enough chunks. Two, it's occupied, and likewise 3G networks, the spectrum's pretty much, you know, getting occupied and becoming quite saturated. So you need new spectrum, you need it from, you know, I think you guys have already auctioned off the 2.5 and the 2.6 and the 2.3 bands. But you also then have to look at, I think, the digital dividend from, you know, the analog to digital migration of TV. Concluding, final comment on just WiMAX, I suppose. WiMAX has an advantage over LTE in that it's available now, but it's not being sort of fulfilled, I suppose. And I think the opportunity for WiMAX is rapidly closing, and, you know, economic conditions are probably not doing that any favours either. Most incumbents favour LTE and want to go down the LTE path. And the opportunities for new entrants, given the economic climate, isn't good. So from that perspective, I think, you know, now really the LTE camp is in the running. These vertical markets, MTM, they do represent a significant opportunity and challenges, you know, from a value chain perspective. You know, there's integration, there's devices, there's everything to consider. Okay. Thank you.